Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOMTV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Proud to have you with us today. On today's pod, I am going to speak to the main character of our new film, Cup of Salvation, the fourth film in the SOM series. His name is Vahe Kushgarian, and he's at the forefront of restarting an entire country's wine region. And on top of that, he pulls off some stuff in this next film that led Forbes to call him the Indiana Jones of wine. I'm not exaggerating when I say this is the most dangerous, thrilling, and frankly, probably emotional film I've ever made, and Vahe is one of the most incredible characters I've ever had in a movie. Right now, Cup of Salvation is playing around the country. We just got back from Chicago. Thank you to everybody who came. The response was tremendous. This weekend, if you're listening to this on release, the 20th, 21st, and 22nd, we will be playing multiple times in Napa at the Cameo Cinema. So if you are in the Bay Area or near Napa, do not miss this. The cast will be there. I will be there. We open up in Atlanta on the 1st of November. And then we have Seattle coming on the 6th. And it will continue and continue and continue. Philadelphia is after that. So go to somfilms.com to find all the screenings for this incredible new film. Right now we're only in theaters. So you want to go to somfilms.com. And don't forget, sign up for somtv.com as well. We have hundreds and hundreds of hours, including new shows every week, that you can watch at somtv.com or on your favorite app, anywhere you stream video. We're going to have a lot of things coming around Cup of Salvation, how we pulled off some of these things, some deeper conversations, and some all-new documentaries around it. So you'll want to go to SOMTV to stay tuned for that. Without further ado, meet Vahe Kushgarian, the main character in the fourth SOM film. Vahe, it's an honor to have you on the SOMTV podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
And there will be two types of people listening to this. Ones who have seen Cup of Salvation, which is not a lot of people yet, and ones who haven't. So we are going to do this podcast trying not to spoil the film. But before you talk, I do want to say Vahe is probably the most interesting subject I have ever had in a film as far as what he does and his charisma. There's a Forbes article that came out recently that called you, for what you do in the film, they called you the Indiana Jones of wine. So let's start there. Are you the Indiana Jones of wine, Vahe Kushgarian?
Thank you. That's the best compliment I've ever had, you know. I mean, short of being compared to George Clooney, which I would love to. I don't know, honestly. I was imagining the things I did for the movie, anywhere close to Indiana Jones. In the wine world, perhaps.
Yeah.
I don't know, Indiana Jones, but definitely it was out there. The country I went to make wine, on the edgy, let's say. Yeah. Oh, I don't know if we can
say some things. I mean, if there's articles out. I think it's known now that we filmed a large part of this movie in Iran. And I'm unaware of any American films since the revolution that have filmed in Iran as a film. Maybe there's been some news. Maybe there's been some journalism. Anthony Bourdain went there, but he was under total surveillance and guided where to go. That's not what we did.
I see. I didn't realize that. Yeah, I guess because I have dual citizenship, so I went in, I traveled with an Armenian passport.
Yes.
And I made sure that I left my American passport back home, you know. Just it avoids to do many explanations.
That's a smart idea when you're going into Iran.
Yes.
To not have an American passport. All right, so that stuff aside, because what you do in the film is amazing, you are part of a very, very, very... the Renaissance beginning of Armenia's restart of 10,000 years of wine history. And it's restarting really with a vengeance. And you are at the forefront, you know? I mean, I would say you're very much in a position like Robert Mondavi was in the 60s for Napa. Kind of coming out of Prohibition. You're kind of coming out of your own Prohibition where there just wasn't wine. So can you tell me just for the listeners, how do you place Armenian wine? How do you explain what it is? Because we've done a podcast about what it is for the culture and the history. But where does it fit in the world market? Is there a place for Armenian wine?
Well, the answer is yes, of course. There is a place for Armenian wine. And the reason there is a place for Armenian wine, it's not the 10,000 or 8,000 or 6,000-year-old history or the oldest winery found in the world, which is in a cave in Armenia, when winery meaning systematic winemaking 6,100 years ago. The reason it is that it has lasted 6,000 or 10,000 years for a good reason, because the terroir is a perfect host for the Vitis vinifera and the vine as we know it today to thrive there. So all these years it has thrived for that good reason, and we have the reason it is we have volcanic soil, we have high elevation vineyards, and over the years, millennia, these few hundred indigenous varieties. So that is why it is it's a treasure trove waiting to be discovered. Because if you go to other countries, maybe one or two or three varieties. Italy might have 20 or 30 varieties. You know, in Armenia we have 300-400 varieties, and we have just scratched the surface. So it means there's a lot of fun things to come from Armenia, and that is the reason that Armenia will have its niche, its place in the wine world, let's say. You know, it will it will give wine consumers different flavors, different styles, different even terroirs. You know, we have 7 wine growing regions, so yeah. I'm a believer, definitely it will happen.
Yeah, well, you better be. So, you know, I in this film, you know, in Cup of Salvation, we get into some very very heavy topics. You know, there's war and there's geopolitics, and the movie kind of ends like a thriller. You know, you're interesting because I think for people to understand the way borders have changed throughout history, grapes are a great way to learn, but Armenians might be an even better way to learn. So you're born, I want to try to get this right. You were born in Lebanon, what is present day Lebanon, is that correct? Or were you born in Syria?
I was born in Homs, a town called Homs, a city called Homs in Syria.
Okay.
And then we moved to Lebanon, my family moved, my parents, when I was 3 years old. So basically, I did grow up in Lebanon, except I had, you know, grandma every once in a while, we'd visit grandma in Syria. But for the rest, until 19 years old, I grew up in Lebanon. Yeah, so, yeah.
And historically, I'm assuming, because it's a really funny thing when you meet Armenians, you find that they were born in Tehran, they were born in Syria, they were born in Lebanon, they were born in Jordan, they were born in strange places that you don't think of. And it kind of begs the question, and this will come back to wine, why weren't you born in Armenia?
My family came from Western Armenia, which is Eastern Turkey now, Anatolia or Eastern Turkey, from a city called Kilis. And then my father must have been 3 or 4 when they were deported during the genocide. So it was, technically it was, in quotation marks, walking distance to Aleppo, which was the first stop. Or, you know, in the Ottoman Empire, there were no countries, but Arabs lived here, Turks lived there, Kurds lived there, Armenians. It was an empire. So it was the lower edge of the empire, and it was what is current-day Syria. So and so he grew up there, and we were born on my, you know. So we, all of us, either went to France, to Lebanon, to Syria, to Jordan, to Israel or Iran. Palestine at the time, Iran, many of them. Iranian community is a little bit older from Shah Abbas days. They were moved there. So a lot of them went. So all of the Greece, these Armenians were dispersed everywhere in the world, Argentina, you know, all of, because they got kicked out from the country. So we all are diaspora Armenians. We grew up in a host nation, a host country. So
I find, and this may be a weird parallel, but when I started making the film, I look at grapes as one of the ultimate ways to see the concept of diaspora. Grapes are spread through the world for different reasons, whether that's religion or commerce or, but Armenians are kind of the same. You guys were either forcibly moved, you were brought to Iran because you were great craftsmen, tradesmen. A lot of people don't know that in the oldest history book, Herodotus was a Greek history writer, and he wrote one of the very first books that talks about the past. He mentions that Armenians are the greatest winemakers in the world, you know, to the Babylonians and to the Persians. And so wine is something that has sort of always been part of Armenians, you know, as far as the historical record goes. I want just for 1 second to talk really quick about Lebanon. So you fought in the Lebanese Civil War, is that correct?
That's how I was in the army, yeah.
You were in the army.
I mean, we were drafted for 1 year after we finished high school. You have to serve 1 year in the army. So I did my service in the army during the Civil War in Lebanon.
And anyone who knows anything about this war knows that it is one of the most complicated, messy, hard to describe in one sentence wars. You know, Moronite Christians and the ruling class and the whole thing. Were there other Armenians fighting in this war, or were you fighting mostly with Arabs, or what was the group of your platoon or your army? Who were you with?
Good question. Yes, many of my classmates served, and during one of those, two of my classmates were shot from the back in one of the barracks, and I do remember where my father, I got his phone call, and they called me in the barracks, loudspeaker, you know, come to them. And because my father thought there was something against Armenians in the army, that they were shooting them or something. He was panicking because his son was there. And I, you know, of course, it wasn't. It was just happened to be they were on guard, you know, defending the barracks, and they were shot from the back. It was a Muslim Christian thing at the time.
Yeah.
So we were serving. I lucked out, and I've served in the army music section. So I was there. I did solfège, and I had to crank hummus for the whole platoon, orange juice, steaks and meat, and like, okay, I had enough of cleaning latrines. So I spent most of my time substituting all of the kids in the army that didn't want to serve by the sandbags, because we were right in the front line. It was easier for me. I was adventurous, so I just stuck it there, and nobody bugged us. We shot a little bit here and there, then we'd grill some meat in the behind. You know, it was a fun time. I don't know how to phrase it, you know. And then there'd be some shooting. We'd count the bullets, and, you know, we would overcount, then we'd sell the bullets, that kind of stuff. You know? So it's... you have to put things in perspective.
Sure.
18, adventurous, no risk-taking and that kind of stuff. You know, so, I mean, it was fun days.
That's describing the Lebanese Civil War as fun days, cooking steak and selling bullets. This is all leading to, because on this podcast, if you're listening to this right now, you are listening to somebody who is not just going to be important in a whole entire region or country. This man is at the forefront with a chisel carving this region out. And in what he's pulled off in the last 15 years is the wines are tremendous. They're incredible. And so it's a very interesting thing that in 10 years, you'll probably be known as one of the fathers of Armenian wine, which is already, I've never seen a region go from making, I'm sorry to insult Armenian, but sweet, lower quality wine to wine that deserves to be at a world stage level in 14 years. It's just, no region does that. And so it's pretty staggering. When you left Lebanon, you went to Italy.
Okay.
So is this where you first had your first wine? What were you drinking in Lebanon? Beer?
In Lebanon, look, no, we did, there was Lebanese wines, mostly rosé. I have no idea why. So if we went to a restaurant and we were on a date, let's say, you know, 16, 17-year-old, 18-year-old, yeah, we would open a bottle of Xara rosé, I think at the time, or Clodou Tournelle rosé or something like that. That's what we did. So we didn't eat. Wine was not part of, it was not a staple on the table. We didn't drink wine. We drank one bottle of wine on occasions. Mostly it was arak. We did with grilled or mezza or whatnot. It wasn't until I went to Italy when I was 19 to harvest grapes, or that was the reason I went to Italy, at least on paper. And that's where we would go to the Enotecas and Bottiglione, that's probably a 2-liter bottle, and that would last for the evening, and then the next day we'd go again and get the bottle. And that was the wine, the exposure of wine. It was an item just like bread, wine, water on the table all the time in Italy. Yep. That was my first exposure to, not fine wine, until one day with a friend, his grandma sent wine, and it was Chianti with a wicker bottle, and it was night and day between what we were chugging down, and this is, I can imagine, must have been really bad at the time, but it was so much better than these other wines that we drank that gave me the first exposure into wine. And of course, later on in the Bay Area, during my restaurant stint, or when I worked as waiter during college, where I really got exposed. And those were the early times. I mean, we had maybe five, six 80s? Brands, Simi, Mondavi. You know, those were the brands that were a few. I mean, the wine revolution, same with food, hadn't started. Alice Water was just, well, no. You know, Chepanis was just kind of a little happening. Bit moving. It was just warming up.
San California Francisco was cuisine. Starting to really exactly. move. Yeah,
the Gourmet Ghetto, whatever. And that's where I had the restaurant. And that's when I got into the Ron Rangers. Their first dinner was at my restaurant with Randall Graham and everybody else. That's when I got into wine. And that's when I fell in love with the business of wine, wine itself, the opportunities that it gave. And I just stuck with it, you know, for the next couple of decades.
Do you have a bottle that you would think of like, this is the bottle I would drink, and it's the one that I would say got me into wine? Like, do you have a bottle that's like, you know, Sessakaya or some crazy bottle or something that you're like, this is the one?
75 Ikem was mind-boggling. I had at anniversary champagne. It was a Grand Siècle from, I forgot what the, it's, anyway, it's a Grand Siècle. And I had a 66 Margaux and 61 Lagrange all in one night. And it was like, whoa.
Change your life.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Those were the ones. Later on, I had many, many, but 61 Lagrange was like.
Well, I always think when you're young and you have these things, you never forget. You know, it's like the movies you watched when you were young are your favorite movies because they changed you, you know? Same with bottles of wine for me.
Yeah.
All right. So you're here in the States and the Soviet Union falls, right? And that's what, 89? Is that correct?
89. Somewhere around there, yeah.
So the Soviet Union goes down. Is that when you were like, I can go make wine in Armenia?
No, not really. That's when a couple of years later, I really want to live in Tuscany, you know. I mean, Armenia was not on my radar. It was earthquake in 88. So my kids weren't born. We were considering whether to adopt from orphans from the earthquake, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And then, no. I opened the restaurant in 1990, my own place, until 19, where the idea of me living in Tuscany was so compelling, and I was so obsessed that I had to live in Tuscany. And in 94 I moved to Tuscany. Okay. And in 96 I started making wine. I leased some vineyards near my house, and in 97 was the first year I went to Armenia, but with friends. They were going to Armenia. You want to come? Sure, let's go. Let's meet in Paris. From there we go. And this is, I'm not wealthy by any, at the time, not even now, by any stretch of the imagination. So we went to Armenia, and that's where I was informed, or I discovered that that's where the birthplace was. That's where it all started. Mm-hmm. And for me, as a wine lover, part romantic, part crazy, I can't pass this out. What am I going to do? And in 98, I got land. In 99, I planted the first vineyards in Armenia. I would almost venture those were the first vineyards planted post-Soviet Union crumble, you know. And then went on. I planted vineyards, built a nursery, you know. Anyway, so that was the first foray. And I would go back once a year. I made a brand, label. That project didn't take off, but then I stayed on, and in 2009 I moved for a gap year with, and then that's when I really got into making wine in Armenia. And, you know, 14 years later, now it's a complete different, I mean, I wouldn't, I wouldn't have imagined we would have done this leap in this fast in short time.
I mean, I think I've devoted 4.5 years of my life following you around the world, making wine and trying not to get shot. this is a big question for me. When you went there, you could have planted anything. You could have planted Merlot, Cabernet, Chardonnay, any of these things that the market wants to buy. First of all, I personally just want to say I'm very proud that you're not doing that. But second of all, why did you choose to embrace the indigenous varietals that exist in Armenia instead of planting Malbec or Chardonnay? Or why? Because you could have made more money, probably faster.
No, well, first I didn't have the funds to do it. But when I wanted to make the sparkling wine, and this is a very true story, I looked at land where it was known to be good for varieties to make sparkling wine. That's in the Tavush region up north. And of course...
So Chardonnay?
Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, that kind of stuff. You know. So that was the thing. And through a friend, I got acquainted, a French friend, supplier, I got acquainted to champagne, a winemaker from Epernay, Jérôme Barré, lovely guy, wonderful friend. He basically said, no, don't do it. Don't get, like what they did in the Franciacorta, which is same French varieties. They're making sparkling wine. And he was damn right. He said, you can do wonderfully with Armenian varieties. He was right. Not because he knew Armenian varieties, but he figured that if varieties have thrived all this time, it means they were right. If Herodotus wrote that this many thousands ago Armenian winemakers were taking wine to Babylon, there was a reason, because they were balanced. They had acidity, natural. You didn't have to putz around with it, put, sacks of, tartaric acid and whatnot. And he was right. He was right on the money. And all I had to do is find the right place to get the grapes. And that's what led me to Kachik, which are the highest elevation vineyards in Armenia. And that's how I made the wine. Because at those elevations, you get phenolic maturity, plus not too much sugar to be able to make them. So in that, you would say you got lucky. I don't think it's lucky. It's just like you do this, it doesn't work. You do that, it doesn't work. It was bound to happen.
I don't know I don't believe in luck, honestly.
Yeah.
I think, you can be fortunate, but luck makes it sound like you just walked into a wall. And I mean, you bought a lottery ticket. You might have won, but you wouldn't have done it if you hadn't bought a lottery ticket. It's kind of like luck is...
Sure.
And you worked your ass off, so you can't say lucky.
No, you're right. Sometimes luck hits you in the face and you don't pick it up. And just in that analogy that you did, most people who win the lottery ticket within a couple of years, they're back to where they started. Because if you don't know how to grab the luck that comes to you, you haven't had enough experience, you don't know what to make of it, what to make with it, let's say. So if you want to call that luck, call it, but it's not really. It just, you have to kind of like push it until you get lucky.
Yeah, I'm happy to see, when I first started, this is probably 12, 13 years ago, something like that, when we were making Somme and doing, getting into the wine world, because I came in as a filmmaker rather than a wine person. I remember it being a real thing. People didn't like or didn't know how or were scared to try to pronounce grapes. I think that's almost gone now. People are not afraid to, if the grape's called Voskehat, they try to say Voskehat. They try. If the grape's called, Cabernet Franc, they say Cabernet Franc. But it used to be people were kind of hesitant, the normal person. I'm talking about like my parents in the Midwest or something. And I'm wondering, when you first brought Arni, which is what I would say is probably the principal red varietal that exists in Armenia, and Voskehat and Sirani and all these different grapes, what was the reaction? Were people kind of interested to try? Did you have to sell it to them? When you started tasting it with restaurants in America and Europe?
Early on was harder. Now it's a little bit easier because times have also changed. Now there's wines from from Croatia, there's from Georgia, there's because the all of a sudden people realize, you know, how much Malbec can we drink, how much this can we drink, especially Veranto, or how much Shiraz. You know, there was a boom for Rosane Shiraz, then there was a crash for Rosane Shiraz, you know, because people wanted to try. So there is not everyone, it's not for everyone, because not everyone is adventurous. But the same with Malbec when it started. It was a niche. I was in the wine business when Malbec, and we would hear, oh, I had a Malbec, like who, what, where? Very well. I remember Altos de Hormigas was like the Malbec at the time in wine list here and there. It was weird. And now, and then it caught some catches on fire. It was the same with New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Australian Shiraz. They used to come. Ruse Run or Kangaroos this and that. This was like, huh?
I mean, Pinot Noir in the United States is like that too.
Until the movie. Then you're going to supply enough Pinot Noir.
It breeds a lot of shit wine.
For example, Georgian Saperavi is getting to be well known. Saperavi, it's very well known on this part of the world, Russia, Armenia. Yeah. You know, Saperavi this, Saperavi that. You know, so Areni it's quite noble-ish, you know. It's not just a grape; it is a very good grape.
Oh, yeah,
so
Arnie.
The potential is it can also it's edgeworthy, it's elegant. You know, for the lack of a descriptor, we keep maybe mentioning similar to Pinot Noir, only in the lead because it has. Doesn't have tannins, it is silky, it is soft, yeah.
I strangely put it closer to Grenache. Good Grenache.
You're right.
Good Rhone Grenache. But like, it's not like that. So it's like when you force yourself to be like, you know, rugby's kind of like soccer. But you're like, no, it's not. It's not at all.
But
if I had to say, I'm like, cricket's like baseball.
You're playing with a ball, yeah.
And so it's the best I can do, but it's nothing like Grenache.
And it should be that way, because if it was like Grenache, then people wouldn't be able to tell the difference. The important thing is to be able to tell the difference and say, wow, this is a different flavor profile. You know, sometimes the different flavor profile works. Other times it's doesn't work because like Dolcetto, for example, yes, it's a different Dolcetto from Piemonte.
Yeah,
you know, it's not for everyone. It's
purple. I love it.
Yeah, some do. Then sometimes Dolcetto, sometimes barrel-aged Dolcetto can be wonderful. Barbera can be very thin, high acidity to barrel-aged versions of it. There's some of it, but it's not for everyone. It doesn't appeal to every taste. Areni is... unripe Areni, not too mature Areni, might be a little bit green in general. But overall, if it's nice, ripe, it is a gorgeous little wine.
Oh, yeah. I think it's one of the great discoveries of my career is that tasting Areni and going, I can't believe there are still grapes out here like this. Because I personally put Areni at the same level I do of any of the... We've debated on this podcast the concept of a noble grape, and that term is so stupid, but it really is one. I mean, it's one of these grapes that holds its own against Cabernet, against Cab Franc, against any of the big important grapes. It's that good, and it really is, and it shows a lot of different styles. I've had some that are lighter, you know, that are nice with a little chill, simple wine. I've had some that are very high class, very age-worthy, very serious wines, and it's there aren't a lot of grapes that can do that. You know,
terroir driven in the sense that if you get it from a certain village at 1500 meters high elevation and you harvest in November, then you have a completely different style of wine. You know, it's not, like Chardonnay, you can have it $5.99 to Montrachet.
I always say this on this podcast, but like the people listening, you're like insider trading right now. This is a grape. And a wine, and a region, and a winemaker that is already exploding, but about to really explode. The film's one part of that, one part of many. And I find it to be very fascinating that you're at the beginning of the selling, meaning like you've already done the making. You've already figured out how to re-terraform the place, rediscover these vineyards, find them in the wild. I want to ask a question that I've always wanted. I wish I could go back in time and ask Italian winemakers or French winemakers in the 1800s, but I can't. But I can ask you this question. If people took Arnie and started planting it in Napa, or planting it in Chile, would that piss you off?
It wouldn't piss me off. It would be akin to people planting Nebbiolo in somewhere else.
In California or something.
You know, Antinori did million years ago, or Martini Brothers Nebbiolo.
Sure.
Never took anywhere. There's some Nebbiolo from Australia. It doesn't, because Nebbiolo is best in Piemonte, not only in the Langa. That's the only place it does great. So if RNA is the same, let them plant it. I had RNA that Italian, for research, they took some RNA, planted it in Piave, I think, in the Veneto.
Yeah, in the Veneto.
It's like watery little thing. It's nothing. Too, yeah.
Which, in the lower part of the Veneto? So it's...
Veneto, yeah. It's in the flatland. It's in the flatland, nothing. Same with, let's not go too far, they planted experimentally in Artsakh or Nagorno-Karabakh.
Which is right. I mean, that's just...
Right next door, let's say. But it is more clay soil different. Again, it wouldn't ripen, the grapes would fall, so they had to take them all off. But that's a sign. It's the same with Riesling or Pinot Noir. You know, Pinot Noir, you have a little bit of leeway where you can plant. Warmer, it doesn't do. The Sauvignon Blanc, same. Riesling, the same. Riesling, you can't plant anywhere. It's, you know, it can be very boring wine, and who wants boring wine? But you get Riesling from Alsace or Germany, it's absolutely wonderful. I think RNA might be one of those grapes. You know, not Chardonnay, Cabernet, those are very general-purpose grapes.
Right.
They can do very well in Tajikistan or Morocco or wherever. But RNA is very... peculiar. In Sangiovese is the same.
Yeah.
You know, Antinori did Atlas Peak in California. I don't know who drinks them. I mean, no offense to Antinori, but it's, no. You know, you want to draw and you do Chianti Classico, you do Brunello, but you don't do Atlas Peak from California, you know. But California had Zinfandel and did Cabernet. Yeah. So, I mean, that's my take. It does not mean that you shouldn't experiment with some varieties. You know, Garas Project did, different varieties. Cabernet Franc is beautifully there. Montepulciano is awesome. But you want to sell Montepulciano from Armenia? No.
No.
You know, is the world interested in? No. The consumer now, with everything... it's past wine, it's a lifestyle thing, and with that comes storytelling. They want to hear a story, and they don't want... It's not about the bottle of wine, it's the story of the wine.
Yeah.
How old is the variety, where
and
it came from,
crap,
who's the winemaker. And Armenia, we have a story to tell. And honestly, thanks to you, not a cheap compliment to you, you were able to weave this story in the movie brilliantly, about the history, the background, where it came from, where it's going. And yes, there's reference to me because I'm the winemaker, but it was very well told story, and hopefully people will enjoy hearing the story. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, this, I could endlessly talk to you. I think whenever the film ends, I've watched it, you get mobbed. Everybody wants to meet you, talk to you. I mean, you do some very dangerous things in this film, but also... I don't think you're thinking about it in a danger factor. You're thinking about advancing the story of wine through into the future. And this is a film that looks at the future by thinking about the past. And that's something I hold very deeply in my heart with wine. And to all of you who are listening, you know, you keep us doing this. So I want everybody listening to find a way to see Cup of Salvation. It will, you know, we'll have news on digital, but right now it's going to stay in theaters for as long as we can. And, you can see all of the screenings that are popping up on somfilms.com. And let's talk about where we can get your wines. The wines, the Iranian wine, your Armenian wines, I'll just give the plug. You can get those at storicawines.com. And that's the importer and distributor in the United States, storicawines.com. And a lot of these are just going to disappear. So again, if you're listening, this is like insider trading. I would go and buy them. They are criminally underpriced for the quality. I'll just say that. And... you should get them. That's what I got. Well, Vahe, we have to get to the Chicago premiere of this film right now. And I hope your liver's in good shape.
I'm ready for it. Thank you. Thank you, Jason. All right. Yeah, well, it's lovely.
Let's go do a Q&A.
Great conversation.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I want to thank Jackson Myers for producing this episode. Our regular producer, John's on his honeymoon. I hope you're enjoying your time off. Please, everybody, if you want to see Cup of Salvation, go to somfilms.com and grab spots. We've been selling out around the country, and we are trying to add screenings more and more. We're hearing from you. We know you want to see it. Go to somfilms.com. And if you love this podcast, please, please give us a great rating and a good review anywhere you listen. It means a lot to us. All right, everybody, be safe and drink a glass of wine you did not expect to drink today. Talk soon.